The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, it is a great, great pleasure for me to have the chance to have a conversation with Secretary Albright, not only because she is who she is and because she wrote this wonderful book, but because I also have a great affection for Czechoslovakia, where I lived in 1968 during the Prague Spring, and where I had a chance to return to for the Velvet Revolution. So this is a double treat. I wanted to start by asking the question that I think anyone who has read this book thinks about. Now, you've answered it in the book, but for those of you who haven't read it yet, tell us a little bit about what impelled you to take this journey to look into your family history.
Well, first of all, thank you, Trudy, and thank you all for being here, and it's wonderful to be back in Philadelphia at this fabulous library, so feel very much at home. Thank you. To answer that, I have to kind of go back to a little context of it. I was raised a Roman Catholic and became an Episcopalian and found out I was Jewish. And the story is the following. What happened was that I had been in government and had a variety of jobs, but it was not until I became ambassador to the UN that I became more of a public figure, and there were a lot of profiles done of me. And I think as any public figure, I began to get a lot of letters, and among them were those that wanted money and a visa and things like that. But some people would say, I knew your family, but they didn't have the names right, and they didn't have dates, or there was never a letter that had everything in it. One person said that he'd gone to high school with my father in 1915, which would have been impossible since he was born in 1909. And so in November 96, I got a letter that had the names right, the dates right, the villages right, and said, I knew your family to have been fine Jewish families. And it was just exactly at the time that I was being vetted to be Secretary of State. And I was in the White House counsel's office, and they were asking me questions like, have I paid my taxes, do I have a nanny, and those kinds of issues. And then at the end, they said, is there anything that we should have asked you or could have asked you that you might want to tell us? And I said, well, it's perfectly possible that I'm of Jewish background. And they said, so what? The president is not anti-Semitic. So I then, over the holidays, talked with my three daughters and their husbands, and we talked about all this. They loved my parents, and they just were fascinated by the additional complexity and what did it all mean. My youngest daughter's married to a Jewish man, and we just had a discussion. What then happened, and I think, I don't know whether people know this or not, but from the moment that you're named until you are confirmed, you are not allowed to talk to journalists. And there was a reporter, Michael Dobbs, from the Washington Post, who wanted to do a profile. And so my office gave him names of people in Europe that he might talk to. So on the day I was confirmed, he came into my office and started handing me these horrible pieces of paper, which were copies of, the Nazis were very good record keepers, of names of my family with names of what transport they had been put on. And I kind of look at this, and he said, you do have to know that many members of your immediate family died in the concentration camps. Well, it's one thing to find out you're Jewish. It's another to find out that how many people died in the Holocaust. And I was stunned. I mean, there was no way to describe how I felt. And the only way I've tried to imagine it is that it's like I was asked to represent my country in a marathon, first time a woman had ever represented. And everybody was watching to see if I could run. And then they gave me a very heavy package and told me to unwrap it as I ran. And that's the only way I can describe how I felt. So I asked my brother and sister to go to the Czech Republic and begin to look at the story. And they were helped by a fabulous man whose name was Thomas Kraus, who headed, you might have met him at some point, head of the Jewish community in Prague, who took them around. So we began to put the story together. But I, to get to your question, is I didn't think that it was a complete story yet. And I wanted to go back and look at everything myself and then put it into its historical context. So the book is kind of in three layers. At the center of it is a personal story of what happened with my family, my father's life as a diplomat, my mother's, and then coming to America. And then it's within this context of a period which is amazingly interesting, I think, 1937 to 48. What was the lead-up to World War II? How was World War II conducted? What happened when the Soviet Union liberated Eastern Europe? And then so there's that. And then the third layer is perhaps the most complicated one, which is the difficulty of decision-making. And what it is to make moral decisions, and how do you decide whether you're going to protect your family and at the same time you have to collaborate, or the importance of leadership. I mean, what a difference it would have been made if Churchill had been prime minister instead of Chamberlain, the choices that leaders make. So it's that kind of decision-making morale. So those are the three layers. But I did want to go back to the story. I was given amazing documents. The Czech Foreign Ministry gave me my father's personnel record. And then there was an institute. Nobody's heard anything? Okay, great. All right, great, yeah. Then there was an institute in Prague that was for the study of totalitarian governments, and they had all the police records from the communist period. So they gave me my father's secret police record. Many times it said, he is a pro-Western Democrat. We don't like him. So so that's the kind of context.
When you were going through those records, Michael Dobbs had given you these papers, but how did you track this very poignant and painful story that you describe in the book of what actually happened to your relatives in the camps?
Well, first of all, I had a cousin that was in Czechoslovakia. She had been with us in England, but she had, by the way, we had never talked about this when I was a little girl. You know, we were together. And then a couple of times when I went to Czechoslovakia in the 80s. But she knew a lot of the story. And then this Thomas Kraus helped. I went to Terezin Stadt, and met a lot of, they had amazing records, and I'm sure that some of the people in the audience have been there, and it's a completely creepy place because now it's very quiet, and it's composed of a fortress, which is actually the prison, and then a garrison town, which looks like a nice town, and people have very good records about how people lived there. And what I then did was to place my grandparents into that story, because I didn't have any written records about them personally beyond those horrible cards. And so it was a matter of recreating the story from other people's memories. And it was a horrible place because what they had decided, they actually advertised it as a spa. And what happened was that I think Czechoslovak Jews knew that they were going to be isolated or put in ghettos, and so they were lured into it, many of them, by saying that this was a very pleasant place and they would be fine there. And then when they get there, it's obviously a hideous place, but, and then the real paradox, that there was so much talent there. They had their own symphony orchestra. They had there's a lot of painting that went on there. They had a school. And then the truly sadistic, barbarian horror of the Nazis who created a group of Jewish elders who helped them run the camp, and they were the ones that then had to choose the Jews that went on to the death camps, because Terezin itself was not a death camp. So I did an awful lot of reading about what it was like and then placed my family within the story.
You write a lot about your father. You had a lot of papers of his and a novel, unpublished novel that he had written. As you were doing this research, what did you learn about him that you didn't know? And what was it like following this trail after he was gone? And did you have any feelings of disappointment that you hadn't been told about your background. How did it affect your whole memory of your father?
Well, let me just in one word say I had no disappointment in my father, none. But I would like to describe the story. What happened was that my parents were Czechoslovaks, and I think it's very important to put that into context. Czechoslovakia was a new country created in 1918, to a great extent as a result of the United States. What happened was that after World War I, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was defeated, and as a result of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, the decision was to create these new countries based on self-determination. And the first president of Czechoslovakia was this amazing man who was kind of the embodiment of the country, Thomas Garrigue Masaryk, who had married an American woman in the last quarter of the 19th century. Her name was Charlotte Garrigue, and he took her maiden name as his middle name. There are not a lot of men that I know that have done that. And the Czechoslovak constitution was modeled on the American one with a serious distinction, which is it had equal rights language in it in 1918. So there was this model country, and it was the only real democracy in Central Europe. And my parents were very young in this. They were born, my mother in 1910, my father in 1909. And he came into this as a young diplomat. And they were very proud Czechoslovaks. That is really, I know that from various discussions all my life with them, and the pride in being kind of the generation that could build this. They also, I found their wedding certificate, and in it, under religion, they put bez vyznání, which means without confession. It isn't that they were atheists. They just did not see themselves as members of any religion. And what I have learned since is that Czechoslovak Jews, more than other Jews, were very assimilated. And paradoxical, because a lot of Jewish writing came out of Prague, but I think the majority, many of them, and this Thomas Krauss told me how really secular a lot of Jews were, and my cousin had also said that they were not a particularly religious family. So my parents, what I had heard about them was that when the Nazis marched in, my parents were able to get out. My mother, I found a little essay that she wrote, said with a little bribery, they got out, and they joined the rest of the government in London, the government in exile. And so my father, we lived in London. I was there all through the bombing and the Blitz. And my father broadcast over BBC into Czechoslovakia to the resistance movement. He then, so he was very identified with the next president, Beneš, and the foreign minister, and very identified with that kind of a thing. We came back to Czechoslovakia. I do not remember my grandparents. I was 2 years old. And when I talked to a cousin and she said, well, I said this to grandmother and grandfather, I realized that I had never called anybody grandfather or grandmother. And so when my parents said, your grandparents died of old age, I was willing to believe that. I won't go through the whole story, but we came to the United States. My father defected and asked for political asylum, and we lived in Denver. When I was getting ready to do this book, probably my next TV series will be that I'm in one of those hoarder movies. But I found in a box in my garage, in which I found an unpublished novel of my father's, which describes the return of a young diplomat who doesn't find any of his family. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I kind of identified this. But I have no criticism of my parents whatsoever. They died before all this came out. I wish we'd had a discussion about it, but I know from knowing them and their values that they did this to protect their children, or me at the time, and then my brother and sister. So I just wish I had had a discussion, but I have no criticism of them whatsoever.
You talk in the book about moral choices, and you mention at the end in the novel, the unpublished novel that your father wrote, you quote a phrase where the protagonist says that the main thing is to remain oneself under any circumstances. And you talk about what you think that meant in your father's case. What did it mean?
I think it meant the being true to the values of humanism, of understanding the importance of the individual, of being a person that cherished democracy and to be himself or herself. And I think that that's what I think. I mean, part of that was hard about writing this book was I had to speculate about a lot of things. And I try to be fair in my speculation and not kind of go overboard. And so, you know, why I have been asked this many times, so I wrote it, is why do I think they converted? And what happened was that we were all baptized in 1941, already in England. So I speculate that it wasn't for them to escape the Holocaust because they were already out. It was not, I think, to fool their friends because their friends must have known about their background. And so it probably, what my mother was kind of more spiritual than my father. Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, was the majority religion. And she had a very good friend who I believe, I mean, they were friends and she was Catholic and they had at some further back time converted. And then I also think it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think that it people in there, and they were very young, my parents. That's the other part. My mother is 29, my father 30, that it would be better for a child to be raised as a Christian after you had seen. So that's the best I can do. Right. And so I know that I know this, that there are people that want me to be angry at my parents. I have no reason whatsoever to be angry at my parents. And when I went to the Pinka Synagogue, where the 80,000 names of the Jews that died, the Czechoslovak Jews who died, is on there, and they showed me the names of my grandparents, I knew that my name and my parents' name would have been on that wall if my parents had not taken us out.
Not taken. I was actually thinking of those moral choices in another way. I mean, your father lived through a very difficult historic period, and you write about his life as a diplomat and his closeness to the quintessential Czech Democrat, Jan Masaryk, the son of Thomas, and also to Prime Minister Beneš. When you became Secretary of State, you must have imagined yourself. I mean, here was Masaryk having to make these incredible choices. Do you just leave because the communists are about to take over? Can you fight them? Do you stay there and try to help the president? I mean, did you have nights when you were dreaming about if you hadn't been Secretary of State now and you had been Secretary of State then or Foreign Minister, what you would have done?
Well, yes, actually. I mean, the thing that I had often thought about what my life would have been completely different. And so in different ways, I went back. The first time I went back to Czechoslovakia was in 67, and I had seen some friends of my parents who told me, as it turns out erroneously, that my father had been tried in absentia and sentenced to death. He had been tried in absentia, but not sentenced to death. It made it uncomfortable, obviously, for me to go there. And so, but when I went in the 80s under the protection of the U.S. government, under USIA, I would walk around and I'd think to myself, I look like exactly like everybody here. I speak Czech. What would it have been like if we had never left? So I thought about that a lot. Obviously, it never occurred to me I'd be Secretary of State. But once I was, and also at the UN, I thought about the decisions that leaders have to make and the calculus that is so hard about wanting to do something and then trying to figure out the consequences of them. And sometimes I'm asked as to whether finding out I was Jewish affected how I looked at issues when I was in office. And I didn't know I was Jewish until I became Secretary of State, but I was ambassador at the UN before that, and the issue was Bosnia. And if there ever was anything that was similar enough, one of the most offensive things that Neville Chamberlain said was, why should we worry about people in a faraway place with unpronounceable names? So all of a sudden, are the people in Bosnia, faraway place with unpronounceable names, and I am part of the decision-making process in the United States. And I remember so well seeing film of people being put on buses and trains and taken to labor and concentration camps in the former Yugoslavia. And never occurred to me that I'd have any decision-making on this kind of thing. And I thought, okay, we cannot stand by and do that. And I do think that I know what I would have done about that. But it's a lot of what-ifs. And I think the hardest part in going back over the history of all of this is that this is why I say leadership makes so much difference. The thing that I hadn't focused on enough until I did research for this book was how tired the British and French were from World War I. They had lost a lot of people. The last thing they wanted to have another world war. And they thought the League of Nations would work. They thought these various treaties that they had signed would work. And nothing worked because Hitler was a beast. But what happened was they kept feeding the beast. And they thought that if they gave him a little piece of that and a little piece of that, that it would work. And it made me realize that you can't, that you have to stand up. And so we did it in Bosnia, and I'm very proud of what we did in Kosovo. But that is, it was that kind of a decision.
I'm just curious, it's slightly off subject, but when you look at decisions that are being made now, Munich is constantly raised, perhaps too constantly, in the wrong situations. And you look at, for example, Syria now, and people raise the issue of Bosnia. Libya, we went in. I mean, how do you define, having gone through all this history, when is the right time to step in? Is there a mantra, a paradigm that fits every case, or can you simply not judge every case by the moral validity?
Well, first of all, there isn't a paradigm. I think that's the hardest part. And I think that that is the burden of leadership, is trying to figure out what is going on. I do think, and this always sounds very clinical, but the bottom line is can you make a difference? Can you do something? I call it the doability doctrine, about if you actually can get something done. And each of the cases is different. Believe me, I've thought about this a lot, and I'm asked about it because of my record on Bosnia and Kosovo. And I think the issue here is the following, and I deliberately said the business about the British and French being tired. I have been asked now many times, shouldn't we go into Syria? And I always say we need to do something, we need to get something done. There are a number of steps I can talk about that need to be done. And nobody ever applauds because we are tired from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that is something that in a democracy one has to take into consideration. And what I think is going on, and I actually agree with, I teach at Georgetown, and I say foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. That's all it is. So what is the toolbox? And it is very interesting to watch what's going on. The toolbox has in it diplomacy, bilateral and multilateral, economic tools, the carrots, which are aid and trade, sticks, which are sanctions, the threat of the use of force, intelligence, that's it. And what's going on, if you look at it, is the administration has made very clear that Assad has to go. They are using their sanctions, multilateral sanctions, and there are steps being taken to give humanitarian assistance, and the president has asked for contingency plans. So the tools are being used, but I think people have to figure out whether they are useful and how they are useful, and the decision makers have to see, and again, it sounds horrible, the cost-benefit. Can we do something? And what makes Syria different from Libya? And what happens, who are the rebels, and what is Turkey doing? I mean, there are a whole host of issues, but there is not a paradigm. The problem is that we all come with our baggage, and it's very easy to, I definitely had the Munich syndrome. The people, other people, when we were making decisions, had the Vietnam syndrome, quagmire. And so everybody has some outlook, and what makes for our decision-making process is to be able to get the issues out, see what the plans are, and try to figure out what the best thing to do is. But it is hard, and there's no way to say it isn't hard.
I'm also curious, in another lessons learned question, you were so much in the forefront on the issue of democracy promotion after the breakup of the Soviet Union. I mean, clearly you remembered what had happened to Czechoslovakia, among other things, and you helped start a community of democracies in the post-Soviet space, in the post-Warsaw Pact space. When you look now at what's been achieved since the breakup of the Soviet Union, what do you think we've learned about how easy or hard it is to establish democracies after the breakup of an authoritarian system? And then when you look at the Arab world, do you see that as a totally different situation where lessons learned from Eastern and Central Europe simply cannot be applied?
I'm so sorry you asked this. I'm chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute. And it's interestingly was set
Egypt,
up
you know, yes.
as something 35 years ago by Ronald Reagan. He had spoken in England at the Parliament in order and explained that democracies were not good at explaining themselves vis-a-vis communism. So he came back to the United States and he started the National Endowment for Democracy. And there's a Republican Institute and a Democratic Institute. By the way, Senator McCain is chairman of the Republican Institute. And then a Business and Labor Institute. And we had no idea what to do. And I was the first vice chair, and we talked about what were the elements of democracy. And one of the first things we did was work in Chile. And what we decided, I have to say, the Republicans chose as their partners all center-right parties, leaving for the Democrats as partners the Revolutionary Overthrow Upheaval Party. And so we decided that we would work across the board, trying just to do the nuts and bolts of democracy. And so I do think that there was a euphoria after the fall of the Berlin Wall and really a sense that it wasn't that difficult, especially in Czechoslovakia, a country that had had a really good democracy, but it is difficult. And democracy is a process. It is not an event. And even in this country, 225-plus years, we're having a few issues. And and people have forgotten that compromise is a democratic word. So the bottom line is it is a
nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan. By the way, I just read Senator Lugar's goodbye speech, and he really talks about the importance of compromise. So, but I think that the issue was that we did think we could teach a lot about how democracy worked and were pretty successful in many places in Central and Eastern Europe. What I think makes it different from what's happening in the Arab world is that the countries there wanted Western support. They had Lech Walesa and Václav Havel and people who modeled themselves a lot on the West. That is not what is going on in the Arab world. And I think that also there's a new issue, and that's the social media. And it is very hard to get people from Tahrir Square into governance and whether political parties are good. But ultimately, I believe it will work. I am a great believer in democracy. I believe that everybody wants the same thing, that there's no such thing as saying X people don't want to have democracy. Everybody wants to make decisions about their own lives, but it's complicated. And NDI was in Egypt. Everybody knows that. And so we are trying to sort ourselves out. But I believe that ultimately people will want to make decisions about their own lives.
I think it's time to take some questions from the audience. I believe that there are folks with microphones. So if you raise your hand, I'll call on you, and then just wait for somebody to come down the aisle with a mic. Yes, in the front row here, this gentleman with the reddish tie.
I need a mic.
It's coming.
And reddish socks.
I'm just curious, Madam Secretary, you served in the Carter administration. What is your reaction to his book equating Zionism with apartheid and the reaction of the Jewish community, which basically has characterized him as an anti-Semite?
Well, I did serve in the Carter administration. Let me say this. I went down. We had the 30th anniversary of the Carter inauguration, and I was asked that question, and I could say, I'm so sorry, I haven't read the book. I was asked whether I thought he was anti-Semitic. I do not think he's anti-Semitic. I do not agree with his approach on now what he talks about in terms of his assessment of what Israel is or its relationship. But I have to say that what he did in terms of the Egyptian-Israeli relationship was a very important one. And what people are really worried about now is what happens to that. So as a president, I think he really tried very hard in order to bring Chairman Arafat and made and to be able to have the Sadat relationship and to try and get Sadat and Begin together at Camp David. It was very important. But I personally have now read the book. I think it is unfortunate the way that he has portrayed it, but I don't think he's anti-Semitic.
Another question, this lady here.
Hi, Madam Secretary. I was wondering your thoughts on the Chen Guangchen event, if you think that that was handled well or if you think there was a better way to handle that situation.
On the Chinese blind dissident, let me again put context into this. I do think that the U.S.-Chinese relationship is a key relationship of the 21st century, a very complicated one, and a lot of our future depends on our relationship with China. And what I think has happened in the last two administrations has been a broadening of the discussions with the Chinese, so that there is now this political and economic dialogue that takes place where there are a lot of officials from both countries that get together. The talks are planned in advance. And what happened was Secretary Clinton was on her way, Secretary Geithner, in order to have these talks that have been planned for a long time. The Chinese had been here before. And then just before that, what had happened was the new person, Xi Jinping, who is going to be the next leader there, had come to the United States. He had met with Vice President Biden. There was a whole attempt to really try to get a working relationship. The Chinese are obviously a huge country with a huge population with resource needs. There are lots of issues about the South China Sea and a number of issues. So a lot of stuff to do. Even when I was secretary, there was a huge agenda, and we always raised human rights. There's no question. They always raised Taiwan, but we always raised human rights and made very clear, and President Clinton made very clear publicly at a variety of times that their human rights record was had to be changed, that it was abominable. So all that. The thing that is difficult about the Chen issue is the timing of it. I can just visualize. You know, here they had, the reason I went through all that is to tell you they had a lot of plans, a lot of things that they had to do. Something about it, I think, shows the difficulty of how you deal with the Chinese and also what he wanted. And all I know is what I've read in the papers is that I think he did not want to leave China. And let me just say something. You will understand this because of Václav Havel, who is the most amazing dissident that I ever met. And you were asking about people who leave their country and who do not. Václav Havel didn't leave. He wanted to stay in Czechoslovakia. Aung San Suu Kyi did not leave. She wanted to stay there. They had tried to get her out many times. So I can understand why Mr. Chen would have wanted to stay there. Then something, you know, he changed his mind or something spooked him. And so I can't imagine the difficulty of how they handled this. It's not over. I think we don't know. But Secretary Clinton, after the first kind of go-round, made it very clear she got involved in this very personally in terms of saying, you've got to let him out if that's what he wants to do. But it's one of those exquisitely difficult diplomatic issues where we have a lot of business, we always raise human rights, and then this one event happened, which was a complete surprise and very difficult to handle. And I think we don't know where it's going. That's with that. I do think that we are going to make attempts to regularize a relationship with the Chinese. We have an awful lot of business to do with them. And there are going to be military-to-military talks also. And the Chinese themselves are going through all kinds of things that they did not expect with Bo Xilai. So there's a lot of stuff going on. But this is very difficult, and I can understand why he'd want to stay there. But the decision, this does go to decisions. His family is being attacked and apparently persecuted in a number of ways. And the question is how you make the decision. Do you do it on your own behalf? Do you see how you can figure out how to get your family out? Are there people ratting on him? I mean, so a lot of the things that come up in my book over how you deal with Nazis, you know, and the personal decisions that people have to make, what they want to do for their country, what they have to do for their families. So,
let me go all the way to the back, straight in front of me. I will take that one, and then there was somebody further back. Yes.
Thank you for appearing this evening. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Question, could you give us some insight as to the decision-making regarding the Rwandan situation?
Yes. First, let me just say, it's interesting how all these things really do fit together. I was at the United Nations, and again, context for decisions are very important. It had not been easy to get involved in Bosnia, so we can talk more about that. Somalia had been started by the Bush administration during the transition as a humanitarian mission and turned into a military mission, which we pushed to have taken over by the United Nations, but the Americans were the major force there. And what happened was that the Black Hawk helicopter was shot down and Americans were dragged through the streets and people were appalled. What were we doing there? And then also there were issues to do in Haiti with various happening around Aristide and riots there, and we had sent an aircraft carrier to pick up boat people, and it had to be turned around, the Harlan County. And one of the things that happened, then Rwanda, and I think this is always also hard to say, and part of what I've been talking about in lessons in terms of decision-making, you have to understand what information the leaders had at the time, not the kind of information that we have now, but what information was existing at the time. And I can tell you, because I was obviously involved in it, and also then later in research for my memoirs, Madam Secretary, stuff about Rwanda did not appear in our intelligence. And one of the things that happened was that at the United Nations at the Security Council, a representative of the Secretary General would come in every day and talk about the horrible things that were happening everywhere. And Rwanda was on the Security Council as a member. And the truth is the information was not there at the time. Then what happened was the airplane of the Hutu president was shot down and genocide exploded. I talk about it as volcanic genocide. I was an instructed ambassador, and my instructions were not to vote for an increase in any UN forces because of all this context. And we ultimately didn't. The bottom line is, President Clinton and I have talked about this over and over again. It weighs very heavy on our souls, and he keeps wanting to know what happened. But the bottom line that I've come up with is we should have done something, but I don't think we could get there on time in order to do anything because it happened so quickly. So that was volcanic genocide. And the irony of things was 2 years ago when we were celebrating or commemorating the 10th anniversary of this, we were watching, we still are, rolling genocide in Sudan, and still not enough is being done. So the issue is, it's the original question, how do you decide, and then who's going to do anything about it? What is the element, what is the weapon, tool, who is the organization that is going to do something about it? I have been in charge of now task forces on genocide prevention. I just did one with former Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen in which we suggested that there be an atrocities prevention board within the any administration that can pick up things that are happening very early and gets the information. President Obama just announced that this was going to happen. We suggested in a task force. I am now on a task force with a man called Rich Williamson, who is Governor Romney's chief foreign policy advisor, and we are looking at the whole concept of responsibility to protect. And we do have information now about a lot of places, but the question is still the same as on Syria. Who does it, and is it something where we can make a difference? I think these are the hardest issues out there. And believe me, I wish we'd done something about Rwanda. But I can now understand how hard it is to figure out who, what, who will do it. I mean, NATO can't go into an African country. Everybody's white. So there are real issues about, and the African Union isn't strong enough to do it. So it's those kinds of things that they have to deal with.
There was a gentleman at the back who had his hand up. No hand now? Okay, then we'll come back to the front. Let me go to this side, this gentleman here.
Madam Secretary, you've had such an extraordinary career, and I'm curious as to what you see or what you desire to see as your lasting legacy.
Well, I'm not dead yet. So, let me just say this, and I don't want to sound glib on this, but an awful lot of people paid forward, and I feel that I have to pay back. That is what I am trying to do. I am really grateful to be an American. I think that the fact that we were able to come to the United States and were received in a generous way, and that I was able to have the opportunity to do public service, is beyond anybody's expectation. It never, as I said, occurred to me that I'd be Secretary of State. I do think that I would like my legacy to be that I did stand up, that I do believe in human rights and justice and the role of democracy. And the various things that I've tried to do, that's the direction that I've gone in. And I do think that the reason that I feel that way is the background that actually, that the country that I came from. And I'm very conscious of one thing. I was born in a very small country, and I am now an American of a large country that when I sat behind the sign, the United States, it was an amazing honor. And to have in your hand at all any power of a huge country makes you realize the responsibility. And when I look at that period, what happened was two large countries, France and the United Kingdom, sold out a small country without ever consulting it. And I think that that kind of issue of how large countries have so much power and can make decision over the heads of small countries is, I think, a great lesson that has to be learned. And so I would like to think that I stand up for the little guy, whether it's a small country or human rights. That's what I would hope. But I still have a few years to go.
Sir?
Madam Secretary, would you like to comment on the fact that some of us think that your administration, exceptionally you and your security advisor, never got credit for what I thought was your tough stand about Saddam Hussein and the issue of the possibility of having some weapons of mass destruction, whichever they may have been?
Well, it's a long and interesting story also. What happened was that when we came into office in 93, it was the end of the Gulf War, and I was an instructed ambassador because the ceasefire of the Gulf War had been translated into a series of sanctions resolutions that had to be kept on in order to make sure that Saddam Hussein disarmed and that he stopped terrorizing his people and would give back to Kuwait what they had stolen from. And those were the instructions. And just for a light moment here, Saddam Hussein was really, when people ask me about my pin collection, I always say it never would have happened without Saddam Hussein. Because what happened, I had these instructions that I would say perfectly terrible things about Saddam Hussein constantly so that we could keep the sanctions on. And all of a sudden a poem appeared in the papers in Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them an unparalleled serpent. So I happened to have a snake pin, and I wore it during our discussions over Saddam. And so then the cameras picked it up and said, why are you wearing that snake pin? I said, because Saddam Hussein compared me to an unparalleled serpent. And then I thought, well, this is fun. So I bought a lot of pins, too. But the bottom line here is we were able to keep those sanctions on. And also what is interesting is that the inspectors actually destroyed more weapons of mass destruction than the Gulf War. And it was very hard to make sure that that kept going on. And also, we had very intrusive, we had no-fly zones, and then a number of times where we made sure that he really stayed in his box. I think that the issue over, and we took an incredible amount of time. There was a lot of blame about the sanctions, that they harmed people, and that is one of the issues with that tool. If you have such complete sanctions, what does it do to the population? I think that we did keep him in his box, and the hard part for us was that the inspectors were thrown out in 1998 without all the weapons having been totally accounted for. We did know that we thought that he didn't have nuclear weapons, but we did think that he still had some chemical weapons. And so I was willing to believe that he did have them, but I did not think that they were a threat to the United States. And so I personally thought that that war, that we had him in his box. And we did work very hard, I think, to keep it that way. We're criticized to some extent, but I think on the whole our policy on Iraq was the right policy.
Yes. Madame Secretary, thank you again for being here. I just wanted to know, did you face any challenges, if any, as being a woman in your position in a male-dominated field?
A few. First of all, let me say that when my name came up for Secretary of State by the great mentioners, what they said was that a woman could not be Secretary of State because foreign leaders would not deal with her, especially not the Arabs. So what happened was that the Arab ambassadors at the UN got together and said, we had no problems dealing with Ambassador Albright. We wouldn't have any problems with Secretary Albright. Then what happened was, I wrote about this before, this is the best, being Secretary of State is the best job in the world, but you don't campaign for it. At least women don't know how to do it. So, but there's a lot of maneuvering that goes on. And all of a sudden, people had asked, the women's groups wanted to support me, and I didn't want that. But then somebody in the White House, I never knew who, nor do I wish to know who, said, yeah, Madeline's on the list, but she's second tier. And that made the women's groups just crazy mad, and so there was nothing I could do about it. So, and then what happened was that I was made Secretary of State, and I had no problem with the foreign men. I did arrive in a large plane that said United States of America. And they did know that if they were going to deal with the United States, they had to deal with me. I actually had more problems with the men in our own government. And I have to, in all fairness, say not because they were all male chauvinist pigs, but because I had had a very long career, and they had known me as the carpool mother or the friend of their wife's or on a volunteer board or as a staffer. I had been a staffer on the Hill, and I had made a lot of coffee and done a lot of Xeroxing, and they thought, how did she get to be Secretary of State when I should be Secretary of State? But I have to tell you, my youngest granddaughter, when she turned 7 2 years ago, she said, so what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretary of State.
Madam Secretary, you mentioned a little while ago about Senator Lugar, who seems to be a casualty of partisanship, and you mentioned that compromise is important, but it doesn't seem very possible these days. From your perspective of history and your long experience, can you speculate on what might happen in the future? Are things going to get more partisan?
Well, I think that it's very interesting, the era that I came out of. I did work on the Hill for Senator Muskie, who had been a Democratic vice presidential candidate, Democratic presidential candidate, powerful chairman, who was the first one to run the budget committee. And when I was a staffer, he said, we have to work with Senator Henry Bellman of Oklahoma, who was a Republican, and we worked very hard together. When I was Secretary of State after the 96 elections, 98, and Jesse Helms was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, we had absolutely nothing in common, except that when I went to talk to him, he said, Ms. Madeline, we are going to make history together. And so this man, with whom we had very little that we would agree on, decided that we would work together. And as a result of that, we were able to expand NATO and do a whole host of other things. And we were able to work together very well. And I do think that that is the basis of our system. And I find what's going on really sad. And when you were asking about democracy abroad, when we're abroad, we've been in a number of countries, and we try to explain just the nuts and bolts of democracy. And basically say, you know, one of the things is you've got to put yourself into the other guy's shoes and try to figure out how to come up with something that's good for your country. And they literally have said to us, yeah, like you're doing right now. So the example that we are setting at the moment, I think, is very distressing. And this incapability of saying, you can understand how to get together, I find distressing. I don't want to get into a big political discussion, but the man who defeated Senator Lugar in his victory statement said the only compromise is for all the Democrats to become Republicans, basically. And it's an impossible way to be. And our system depends on some way of trying to sort out our differences. So I am very worried. And I am, it's interesting, I've had a wonderful time on my book tour, and every single time there is a question like that. And I think the American public is fed up with this. And we all want there to be some kind of agreement, some way to get together. And I frankly think the only way to make this work is for all of us to make that very clear, that we will not put up with this. And that it isn't just civility. It's the fact that we have very serious problems, and I think we have to work together. I am worried, and I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about that.
On that note, Madam Secretary, I want to thank you for a wonderful discussion. And let's
thank you all very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.